Valley with Tony Simpson, Ryan Champion and Jack Bennion.
Hello everyone, welcome to Absolute Rally. It's good to be back. It's episode 6 of season 5. I think we are now, yeah, I think we are. As ever, we've got Jack Bennion in our remote studio. Last week he was involved in car chases, he was in rally, he was in everything, basically all the way through last week's podcast. We had sound effects, which is good, and I'm excited to hear what particular sound effects you're going to have for us this week. But hello, Jack.
Hello, how are you doing?
I'm doing everyone, I'm making sure no one's doing me, my friend. So at this point, we all say hello, Ryan Champion.
Hello, Tony Simpson and Jack Bennion.
And you didn't do your normal joke this week?
No, I didn't.
You didn't say hello, Ryan Champion, which is throwing me now.
I'm too predictable. You know, I don't want to be too predictable. So.
No. Perish your thoughts. Boys, we've got a fair amount to discuss. I've got a funny feeling this week is going to be quite unique. Following on from kind of our conversations last week, I want to mention this first and foremost. The Group N debate kind of cracked on as well. And Tom Cave, who of course is doing the British Rally Championship, he's been doing BRC for the last few years off and on, obviously doing the DMAC Drive Trophy and things like that. He waded in kind of going where we went, because obviously there was a whole debate on his Facebook page about it. And Jack, I don't quite know what we started. Well, you started it, and then we kind of ran with it, and then someone else ran with it.
Yeah, absolutely. It seems to go down quite well, isn't it? That's the idea of Colin Dan. And then, you know, we like to be sort of kind of be the voice of motorsport if we can in various places, and just try and raise debate and you know, look at different situations that are happening in rally at the minute. And I think it was quite a well-found one, and there seems to be some good news coming towards that. So it'll be interesting to see in the next couple of weeks. I've heard a few things that might be happening in the future. I don't want to say too much just yet, but yeah, it looked like it created a bit of interest, to be fair.
What, with regards to some new Group N cars or some drivers using them?
Neither of those things. maybe some incentives for getting yourself a Group N and going out and rallying it later. We'll see what happens in the next couple of weeks.
Okay, because, you know, again, we used to have those, didn't we, right? You know, the lads in the Mitsubishis, obviously there was the Evo Challenge and stuff, which obviously you won, it has to be said, and you got a year as a factory driver and things like that. But there was also other incentives, wasn't there? You know, the Peugeot Challenge had things and things like that, and Subaru, I know STI even put some prizes up for finishes on WRC rounds and ERC rounds. Maybe that's what will get it going again.
Yeah, but that's why it's changed, hasn't it? And that's why there isn't the focus on Group N, because it hasn't been backed by the manufacturers. And it's like we said last week, you know, the fact that R2 has been heavily supported by the likes of Opel and by M Sport with the Fiesta, it's taken the focus in that direction. And when you had Mitsubishi and Subaru supporting the Group N cars actively, then again, it drew interest that way. So I think it's like we said, whenever you've got manufacturer backing for something, they promote that, you know, they give it the PR, the drivers see that, and then people go towards that. So it just tends to ebb and flow with where the manufacturer backing is, I think, because let's face it, there isn't much in motorsport. So if there is something on offer from a manufacturer, people tend to gravitate towards it.
Absolutely. Now, a couple of things that have broke over the last 24 hours, which it kind of got me thinking, actually, and it got me thinking more about the Group N debate again, more so. I'm not sure. I could be wrong on this, and probably Ryan will put me straight on this. But great news for Craig Breen and Chris Meek, both confirmed to go and do Rally Corsica. And two drivers that I can't ever remember driving a Group N car after all that debate, funnily enough.
You're putting me on the spot there. Well, Chris obviously came up through the Super 1600 ranks, didn't he? So he was always front wheel drive, and you know, and no, I can't say
I can't even remember him doing a one off event or anything like that. Jack, can you remember either of them driving a Group N car other than the ST, obviously, for Craig?
I can think of Chris driving Subarus, but I think they were all wheel cars.
Oh, wheel cars, weren't they?
Irish Tarmac. I don't think he has driven, not in competition anyway, a Group N car that I know of, that I can remember.
There you go. We've just blown our whole argument apart, haven't we? There you go. We did it.
No.
Oh, sorry, Jack.
It's all right. I wrote another column this week, sort of carrying on from the Group N debate we had last week, and basically just to say that, you know, it's not necessary to drive a Group N. You know, it's not the be all and end all. And I did kind of right a few wrongs. I think a few people criticised me a little bit for saying that, you know, you had to go and do a group pattern, and that, and people kind of took it at R2s, but I thought R2s weren't worthwhile, which is, it's not the case at all.
No,
what I do think is worthwhile is group ends are a cheap way of learning, well, not cheap, a cost-effective way of learning your four-wheel drive craft, and that's just something I wanted to correct after a few texts I had last week.
I'd back that up 100%. I think you're right, and I think the difference is if you're in a fortunate position where you have a little bit of sponsorship or you have some backing, then you go with what's current, and R2 cars are very much current, but it's still an expensive formula, and all we were saying was that Group N is very cost-effective.
Yeah, there you go. Right, I want to crack on with a few bits and bats. Obviously, news breaking and things like that. And I don't know whether this is. I suppose it is current, and the reason why I'm hesitating is because we're back in the realms of Tony trying to pronounce an overseas driver's name, which always causes amusement. I don't know, right now everybody's kind of going, what is it, who is it? Right, there's going to be a Hyundai R5 on Corsica. We've just been talking about, obviously, the great news that Craig and Chris are going to be out on Corsica with the Abu Dhabi Total Citroen Racing Rally Team, and there's also going to be a Hyundai R5, I assume, making its competitive debut, because obviously it made its debut running as a car zero, if you like, on Ypres. But there's an R5 on Corsica, Jack.
Well, it's three, actually.
It's three, right?
Yeah, there's Stefan Sarrazin, Kevin Abring, and Fabio Andolfi as well. So three cars making definitely going to be the WRC2 debut. The only time we've seen them out previously was as the course car on Ypres, so it will be the competitive debut for the car.
What was the final surname? I know, obviously, we know Stefan Sarrazin is. We know, obviously, Kevin Abring. What? Who was the third, sorry?
Andolfi, as far as I know.
Are you going to go with Andolfi?
Yeah.
Okay, all right. You know, you don't. I'm not trying to plant a seed of doubt. I'm just asking.
No. I'm fairly sure with that one. I'm sure Ryan will correct me if I'm wrong.
I would if I knew any better than you, but I don't think I do.
Wow, hang on a minute.
Tweet into Absolute Rally with your corrections.
Yeah. Actually, I'm sure people will, because I've had a fair amount of stick over the years of getting pronunciations wrong, but I'll still keep doing it. Of course I will. Right, so going on from that, I don't know whether this is a recent story or whether this is just a non-entity story, boys, but I read something online the other day, and it was Lappi confirmed that he has been around Toyota's workshops. Now,
We've already done that.
Yeah, I know, that's what I mean. And I thought, well, is this just old news which is being regurgitated, or is he just been to his local Toyota dealership and had a walk around?
It was included in our story that said that he was leaving Skoda at the end of the year,
So it's been regurgitated, the story, then. Obviously, they're trying to get something going, I'm guessing, that if they're regurgitating the same story, but still there you go.
But you see, the difference is his local Toyota dealer is Tommy Mäkinen Racing. That's the difference.
Ah, I see what you did there. Okay, fair play. Now
he only went to buy a Yaris. That's all he went for. It's got wings on it.
It's got an ironing board on it. That's what it's got. It's got an ironing board on it. There'll never be a crease in any of their boys' race suits next year. I can say that. Okay, so I wanted to. There's a great feature again, and again, stuff that we don't tend to. We tend to skirt around a little bit, and obviously we are always going to talk about, you know, what's going on WRC, and we talk about BRC and ERC and stuff like that. But the behind-the-scenes stuff, which, funny enough, which is why later in the podcast we've got Michael Paston from Paston Pace Notes, who's going to be talking about how their company has developed and how Pace Notes, you know, for the clubmen and beyond have become so important, and how their company's grown. But I'm keen for the podcast to get involved in other things around the sport, and perhaps what we don't realise, and testing and development. You know, we've touched upon it, and, you know, I think Ryan and I have spoke about it in the past as well, but there's a nice feature here, Jack, with regards to Matthew Wilson putting some serious clicks on this new Fiesta. Well, it's the slave shell with the new running gear, and they've been over to France.
Yeah, they took it to France to a place where some Dakar teams go and test their cars, so it's a place sort of renowned for being quite rugged and tough on cars. Wilson said the car went really well and was really happy with how the car performed. Obviously, he's going to say that, isn't he? But you know, he did seem very positive about how the car was going, and he had Stuart Loudon sat in with him, which was quite nice as well, him being part of the M-Sport test team. It's another Brit involved in developing a 2017 car, isn't it? So that's nice to see as well.
And there's also a serious amount of tea cakes. which also comes part of the gig as well, which I bought some yesterday. I'll be honest with you, I'm a sucker for them, to be perfectly honest with you. But right, you've been involved with doing this stuff, and you know, Matthew obviously took a step back from frontline competition. He's obviously managing the Bentley project now, the racing side for M Sport. He seems to be relishing this testing, and you've done this type of stuff before. Is it still exciting, or is it the fact that it's a 2017 car probably it's just exciting anyway, even looking at it?
Yeah, I think you've probably hit the nail on the head there with next year's cars. Obviously, it's a leap in performance. They're a very exciting new category. So, you know, inherently to be one of the first people who's driving those cars is going to be great fun. And I'm sure also to drive, you know, they're incredibly exciting. If he was just doing 1,000 kilometres in an R5 car, for example, he might not be quite so exciting about it, because that's probably what some people don't see, is the slightly less glamorous side of it. Testing where literally you just need 1,000 kilometers on a transmission, or 1,000 kilometers on a set of dampers, or whatever it is, and actually you are just going round and round and round and round, and obviously it's great to get miles in the car, but some of it isn't all that exciting. But to be driving a brand new car for next year, then obviously that does bring the excitement. But you know, funnily, I read something a few weeks ago about Tommy Mäkinen testing obviously the Yaris as part of the Toyota program for next year, and somebody said, well, what does he know about current World Rally cars? But again, it's irrelevant, because when you're doing a lot of this test mileage, it's about getting mileage on components, making sure components work, and as long as you're a good, capable driver, which Tommy Mäkinen is clearly more than that, then he can do that job. And he can also, as Malcolm Wilson did with the Fiesta, get a real feel for the philosophy of the car. Does it feel right? Does it feel like it's going to work? You don't have to be a current WRC driver to feel that.
I know, again, it's something which people don't realise, and the effort that goes in behind the scenes, and the test team, you know, I've just been reading, you know, Stuart obviously has been on the programme, and Stuart is actually talking about, Jack, the professionalism of working even with the M Sport test team. Again, do we miss a trick sometimes to getting people involved, and maybe even, you know, I'm not trying to sell the idea as such, but maybe people need to go and watch what goes on, you know. And I know we obviously, there's people who go to service on GB and things like that, and WRC rounds, the service parks are full. But is this almost now an aspect of the sport? Perhaps we need to pull the smoke and mirrors away and let people go and see it, as opposed to seeing it retrospectively.
Yeah, I suppose so. I think, watching testing can be just as fun as watching any rally, I suppose, in some aspects, especially watching the 2017 cars. They're bound to be spectacular. I think the issue with sometimes with watching testing is whether it's safe to access if they're in a forest, or whether it's sometimes a safety concern, whether there's marshals present and all that sort of stuff. But, I don't see why more people can go and watch testing and see the cars being driven. It's definitely going to be good to watch.
Now, just moving on from that, and as I say, we wish the M Sport team the best of luck, and we can't wait to see the new car, because obviously that is supposedly going to be going into a new shell, which comes later next year, I'm led to believe. So I look forward to seeing that anyway. But moving on, David Higgins. We were hoping to have David on, and unfortunately we haven't been able to get him this week. But right, he's hungry to go back to the States.
He's obviously had an incredible amount of success there, hasn't he? David's really made a career for himself, a rebirth of his career, if you like, because it's been difficult for British drivers to make careers out of rallying over recent years, unless you make it in WRC. We've seen that Chris Meek has obviously made that grade now, but before that, he obviously was really fighting to get his position at WRC, and below that level, it is very, very difficult. You know, in this country, we don't have the sponsorship, we don't have the manufacturers to allow drivers to earn a living out of the sport. And we've talked about it in previous weeks. David, Mark, Niall McShay, etc., have all also done the same in China, looked at other options to continue driving rally cars and making a career from it. And David certainly has been dominant in the American Championship. He's really made a name for himself there, and keen to have more success there.
Absolutely. Jack, you know, I think every time we speak to David, he always creates more competition. Obviously, we had Drewy on. Craig Drew is co-driver as well, maybe 6 or 7 weeks ago now. But they crave the competition. But, you know, he's already looking perhaps that they may have to go global rallycross. Obviously, you just had Chris Atkinson over there driving the STI-supported car in global rallycross, and that may be a path that he may need to go down.
Yeah, he seems to enjoy his rallycross outings when he's done it before, doesn't he? So I don't think he'd be too upset with that. But yeah, I think there is a bit of a lack of competition there, isn't there? And it'd be interesting to see what happens with the American Championship next year with all that's going on over there, politics-wise, in terms of whether there's going to be a split championship or whether it's going to carry on. I guess Subaru was looking at that quite closely and deciding whether it's still worthwhile for them to be there. But at the end of the day, Subaru are there to sell cars, and as long as David's winning championships, I'm sure that's good for them.
Absolutely, absolutely. Now, just coming back again, slightly more closer to home, and talking about Wales Rally GB. Do we still call it that, Jack? Or have we got to call it the Ensure?
What's it? The official title of the event is the Day Ensure Wales Rally
GB.
See,
right, I don't know about you, but I've only just got my head around not calling it the Network Q.
I still call it Lombard RAC.
The RSC still comes out, doesn't it? A lot of people still call it the RSC. Or in Spain, I remember going to Spain once and they were talking about the RAC rally. And it took me a while to realise they were talking about the RSC.
You thought they were just clocking your RAC, didn't you? That's probably what it came down to. But Rally GB, Ian Campbell managed to, obviously, BRC manager, but also clerk of the course of Rally GB. Jack, been out checking the stages, posted some nice bits and pieces on social media and stuff like that, and it seems odd to be getting ready talking about GB in it's round the corner now, isn't it, really?
It's insane how quickly it's coming around, isn't it? And you know, it's a bit earlier this year as well with the calendar switch in Australia going for the last round and GB being the penultimate round, so it comes even quicker this time, and we've been planning for a good 2 months now about stuff that's going to happen towards GB, so it's a real year round thing. But yeah, I did speak to Scummer briefly yesterday, and he was very positive about how the stages felt and how they looked and all that sort of stuff. It seems to be in really good condition, so that's good moving forward. And it's always a worry when a rally moves forward, a gravel rally, because obviously it's shorter time to prepare the event for the next year, but there doesn't seem to be any issues so far.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, just moving on from that, by the way, and again, GB, it's going to be weird this year because I'm probably just going to be out watching, and I haven't done that for such a long time. And you know what? Weirdly, I don't know if this is a sign of age, Ryan, maybe you can relate to this perhaps more than Jack. I'm actually really looking forward to it. I haven't done it for 3 years, and I love it, and I love everything it is. I'm actually looking forward to kind of taking a step away from it and being a fan again.
Do you know why that is? It's because you'll be able to afford to buy Christmas presents this year.
I thought Heather looked excited when I said to her that I wasn't going to be doing GB this year. That's probably what it was. But no, it is genuinely. And do you know, sometimes, and I don't know whether you get this, guys, obviously, you know, you live your life in it now, Jack, and Rye's lived his life in it for such a long time, and so have I. Sometimes you forget how to just be a fan, and I actually just want to go and be a fan again. Just thought I'd put it out there. And
no, but you're right. I mean, it is great to certainly go and watch, and I still enjoy watching on rallies and you know, and really seeing the difference between the cars, the drivers, and you know, really picking up who's on it and who isn't. It's still great to see. We still have one of the most spectacular sports in the world, and that's what it's all about. It's all about watching it and seeing that excitement.
I think for me it does. It's spectator anyway for me, really, in terms of events I'm covering. So it's quite a similar thing for me anyway. I'm not in a car or anything like that. So it's relatively similar when I go and spectate to when I'm working. Really, it's just a more intense sort of atmosphere. But yeah, it's always good to try and go to an event and just spectate and just chill out.
Obviously, the organisers are also trying to do so many things. Obviously, Chumley is going to have this Group B festival almost at Chumley Castle, isn't it, Jack?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's basically like the church days last year. You know, the running the grounds basically, but they're gonna have a big hospitality thing there, and they're gonna have a big a big Group B festival backed by MN, so we're going to be involved in some of the stuff that's going on there, and Mickey Biazion is headlining the guys who are going to be there, and I think they're going to have the biggest collection of Group B cars since 86 in one place. It's going to be absolutely enormous, so hopefully they can pull that off. I don't, you know, obviously we don't know if it'll happen until the actual weekend, but yeah, you
can, I hope he's funny, because when if he's headlining, he's got to be a funny man. That's a pressure job, trust me. Headlining, you've got to be funny, but still, there you go. A couple of other bits and pieces before we crack on. I wanted to mention, actually, Jack, I was gonna kind of do your column in the Any Other Business, but I've got loads of little Any Other Businesses this week, which I'm gonna come to Rise in a second. But just crack on. You mentioned one or two people in your column this week, drivers that I've watched grow up and stuff like that, and you make special mentions. Gary Pearson, who's currently doing the Scottish Championship in an R5 Fiesta, and about how he learned his craft and stuff in an R2 Fiesta. He did learn his stuff, but I remember Gary in a Micra. Gary had a Micra the Micra to an R1 Twingo. So Gary, in some ways, it has, you know, the only leap he made, he missed out R3. He's done R1, R2, okay, didn't do R4, but gone to R5. And, you know, Gary really, really has. He's been around 5 or 6 years, and every year he kind of took that step up. He's won, ticked the box, moved on and stuff. And Gary is a driver, and to be fair to him, and I can say this because I know Gary very, very well, but to see a man of his stature, and he's a very tall lad in a Micra, was always highly amusing for me. But he looks much more at home. He looks much more at home in that R5 Fiesta, and I wish him the best of luck for the rest of the year. But again, there's lots of drivers that you've dropped in. You know, Callum Black made his debut last weekend in the R5 Fiesta. Again, Callum is another driver that I've watched, you know, over the last few years, kind of tick the boxes and come up. And I think what's interesting is that the drivers you've mentioned is where I'm going to with this. They've ticked the boxes on the way up. They haven't just jumped.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And yeah, like I said a bit earlier in the podcast, you know, it's the idea of the column was just to say that, you know, you don't have to do a Group N car to be a good driver. And that was, you know, basically, I was just alluding to a couple of relevant people who struck my attention over the next couple of weeks, because obviously Callum's just made his debut in the R5, and Gary can wrap up the Scottish Rally Championship next weekend on the Callaway Hills Rally. So they were just two relevant people that sort of came to mind when thinking about, you know, if you do it properly, if you do, you know, if you move up the ranks, like you've just mentioned, it is, you know, the good drivers do come to the top eventually. So yeah, it was just basically just to point out that, you know, I wasn't saying that, you know, you can't be a good driver and you can't make it to the WRC or wherever you want to go if you don't drive a Group N. It was just just a suggestion that it was a cost-effective way to do it.
This is Absolute Rally. Team Coordinate, your perfect travel partner for all your European, Manx and Irish motorsport travel. Whether you're a competitor, marshal or a motorsport fan, we have the connections and discounts available for ferry travel to and from the UK. Team Coordinate, we can cater for individuals, teams or group bookings. Working with organisers of race, rally and classic touring events, we take away the hassle of travel with bikes, cars, trailers and trucks, accompanied or unaccompanied. Team Coordinate. Call Dane or Donna now on 44 1904 766787 or email us on info@teamcoordinate.com. This is the Absolute Rally Podcast.
Welcome back to Absolute Rally. Now, before we move on to our Any Other Businesses, because Jack, have you got yours ready this week? Yeah, okay.
Yep.
Okay. Apparently Ryan's got an epic one. So, and an epic.
Oh, he's got to go first then.
And an epic
on
the other business. So, hey, see what you did there. Hey, you brought your own connotations to that. That wasn't me. A couple of things I wanted to mention. It's not any other business, but it kind of is. It's rally. I went out to watch the promenade stages last weekend in the absolute torrential, persisting down rain, and again, it's not very often I get out and watch a rally. It was on my doorstep. I felt I had to. I felt compelled to, and there was hardly anybody out, but the marshals were out. They were absolutely sodden, and I still got to talk to the guys over at Simpson Skoda as well, and I managed to hear a Skoda R5 singing its way all the way along those promenade stages, right? Because you and I both know, because that's what all you do. You just have them singing on the rev limiter all the way up and down the prom.
Yeah, the
the Rally of a Thousand Corns, as it was known when it was a British Championship round. I say that in inverted commas. But funnily enough, I went last year when it was a Promenade Stages, and it was a lovely sunny day, and there was thousands of people there. So yeah, it just goes to show what the weather
is. There was me, some bloke with a dog, and some other bloke. I think that's about it. And I felt really for the organisers, because I know how busy it can get over there. But I did bump into James Grint, which was great. James Grint, former teammate of mine, obviously did the British Rally Championship and a DS3, now doing British Rallycross and some European Rallycross in a supercar. And he proceeded to basically talk at me for 25 minutes to try and convince me to go and do British Rallycross as opposed to go rallying. So... while his young lady, who was making her debut in a Peugeot 106, that's why he was there, and she had a good run and had good fun. James is on good form. Doesn't look like he's coming back to rallying anytime soon, but he does fancy a Mark II Escort to go and play in. Which brings me to another story, Jack, that I read this week in MN with regards to Nick Carr.
Nick Carr,
again, is a young man. I watched him do BTRDA Rally first, I think it was, and he kind of worked his way up, and then he came up to the British Rally Championship with an R2 Fiesta this year. Don't think it's quite worked for him. And then I read a story, obviously you've done the article there, with him having a historic car built for next year.
Yeah, that's right. Funnily enough, I did write that one. I don't usually write anything for the historic page, and I had two stories on there, so it was just quite unusual for me. But Nick's had a difficult year in the Fiesta, and it's a real growing issue, I think, in the people have found in the juniors this year, that if you've got a 1.6 litre Fiesta, you're just not going to be competitive with the Opel Adams and the R2T Fiestas at the front. The turbo cars obviously got that bit of extra grunt. So Nick's really struggled, and he did say to me on the phone that he's pushed on really hard at some points this year and set some really good stage times and been quicker than any other 1.6 litre Fiestas, but not been in the same postcode as the front running car. So he said if he was going to carry on, it'd have to be in a top line car, and that's going to cost him a lot of money. So obviously he builds cars with his Rally Sport company that he works for. They built the 131 Fiat that Matthew Robinson drives it on national events. So he's obviously well clued up with how to build historic cars and that sort of thing, so he's going to drive a Mark II Escort I think it'll likely be for a full campaign in 2018, but he'll be doing the RAC next year and a few one-off events.
So is the R2's going for sale then, is it? That's going to be sold?
It's gone to Tony Carinante in the BTRDA, and it made its debut on the World Cup last weekend, and I think they had an off actually. It was Tony and Chris Williams, guy we know quite well, and I think they had an off quite early on in the rally, which is sad to see. Tony's got a Subaru as well, and that, I think he had an off in that earlier in the year, so not a good event for him, but hopefully the car's okay. I'm not quite found out about that yet.
Well, I hope everyone's okay there, not the car's not too badly damaged. Right, I wanted to just ask you before we went to one of the other businesses, to be honest with you, is that incredibly brave to kind of just come to the conclusion, right, I still want to go rallying, I want to go and obviously we're not going to be in a position where we can crack on and go in, go to an R5 or wherever it may be. I'm going to build myself a nice Mark II, and I'm going to go historic rallying, because he's a relatively young man we're talking about here.
But I think again, it's just a sign of the times with how expensive it is to try and compete at the top level. I mean, let's face it, it's never been cheap. But in the old days of one make championships, you could buy a front running one make car, as Tony, as I know, whatever it was at the time, whether it was £10,000 or sometimes 20, but not now 50 or 60 to get, like we said, a front running R2 car. And it's year on year as well, because there's new cars coming out all the time. So yeah, I think it's just one of those things. It's very, very difficult to compete at the front, if you're privately funded. And funnily enough, Nick followed in some ways similar to what Ash Slights did, and Ash won the Formula First Championship as well, and then Ash moved on to a Yaris that they built again through the family business, the family motorsport preparation business, and Ashley came to the same conclusion that this isn't for me. I'm going to build a Mark II Escort and enjoy my rallying, and ultimately people have to do it for fun, haven't they? And it's so difficult to get to the top unless you've got a lot of money behind you. That if you can't do that, well, you know, maybe rally for fun and enjoy it.
Absolutely. Right, I'm gonna quickly rattle through my any other businesses because I know Rye's gonna cause a little bit of a chat and stuff like that. So. Just kind of a doth of the cap. Again, feels very UK centric this week. I apologise to our overseas listeners, but it's all very valid. As we mentioned, Callum in the new R5 Fiesta, again, Steve Black, who I know quite well, his old man, obviously from Steve Black Garages and stuff like that back in the day. It's great to see that SBG registration back on a rally car, and great to see Callum back out as well. And I know, Jack, you had him down as the start of the rally on the Woodpecker stages. Now, I also wanted to pass on my best to Cameron Davis, rather. And I said Cameron Davis then. Cameron Davis, winner of the inaugural new Fiesta ST Trophy in BTRDA this year, and he's already planned to move on to the British Rally Championship. Some fantastic drives. George Lepley took the first win in the trophy this last weekend, just gone on the Woodpecker. Wasn't troubled, unfortunately, by you, Jack. You were my tip in the SV Trophy. You let me down. So my any other business, by the way, is basically I am going to do a 30-second interview with Jack Bengen with regards to his Woodpecker Rally. So Jack Bengen, thanks for joining us on Absolute Rally. It's an honour to have one of the front running ST drivers with us. Just talk us through your Woodpecker Rally.
Yeah, it was an interesting way to make your rally debut. The conditions were pretty tough and they were changeable all the way through the stages. So trying to build on early pace and trying to, you know, consistently learn through the rally was quite difficult with entering a corner and not knowing how much grip you're going to have, which is something I hadn't really thought much about before the rally, but something I definitely thought about halfway through the first stage. But yeah, great stages, fantastic rally, and you know, the car was pretty much faultless all day and really enjoyed the day. It was fantastic.
There you go. That was a 30 second interview with our superstar rally driver Jack Bengen. Well done, Jack. No, Jack, I thought you did a stay. It's very, very easy to say and sound condescending, but it's a very difficult thing to go and do. Very wet rally. I know Rocky was alongside you as well, and probably gave you the mind talk, yeah, and everything else, because he's a very experienced guy and he sat with a lot of first time drivers, works with a lot of juniors as well, and obviously the guys at Rally Me as well, who have a lot of first-time drivers go through their books as well. So, I was looking at the car. I was down the workshop on Monday, and not a mark on it. Very dirty, but not a mark on it. And that's the way to bring home a rally car, especially on your first event. So that was...
Especially when it belongs to
John Goff. Any other business very quickly before I go, after all the things we said about Sebastian Loeb not quite getting on the pace with Rallycross, he ended up on a podium last weekend. So maybe that's it. What we need to do, we need to talk about him more leading up to events, and he might get some more podiums, but I don't think he's going to be too worried, really, is he, in the scheme of things? We will do Jack's any other business now.
Well, mine was going to be a bit about the rally debut, but you've kind of answered most of the questions there. So just a, you know, a brief. I finished 121st in the rally, and it was a really tough day, to be honest. It was tough to get the car to the end, and as a novice, I don't think I could have picked the worst rally to make a debut on. But I was really happy with how the car was, and got to say a big thank you to John Goff for having me, and to all the NASCAR style sponsor thank you like DMAC and Pace Notes that you can have later on. For sorting me out, but yeah, what an amazing day! And the last stage was, I think I described it as what the Crucible is like to snooker players. It was just like a carpet going through there, and had a really good run through there. I really enjoyed it. So, big thank you to all the people that helped me. But I should probably point out that, you know, it's the penultimate round of the BTRDA Rally Championship, and Charlie Payne has won the championship after Luke Francis crashed out on the second stage. He had a roll at a hairpin. So, Charlie and his Fiesta S2000, it's got a 2-litre engine, managed to win the championship, and Stephen Petch got his first overall BTRDA win on the event as well in a Fiesta R5 Plus. So really good event, nice season champions crowned, and nice to see Adam Trouble in one's championship situation.
Jack, one last question before we go to Ryan's any other business. Right, your level of anorakism with regards to rallying is phenomenal. It's fair to say, right? You and Rye, the trick always was surround yourself with people who know more than you, and which is what I've tried to do with this podcast, right? And I'm not just saying that, but does a lot more make more sense to you about the sport now you've done one event?
I think, I think seeing it from that side, I think it will make a good feature because, you know, certain things happened and, it was really interesting to sit on the driver's side and see how everything works from that side because that's something you just can't know until you actually do it. It's, you said, levels of anarchism or whatever, I wouldn't necessarily agree with that, but I do a lot of reading and do a lot of research and you can't do that with a rally. You've just got to do it to know what it's like to compete. So that was the main reason behind doing it. And to be honest, I enjoyed every second. It was absolutely fantastic to sit on that side of the seat and really get a good perspective of what it's like to be a rally driver. And I think I'll maybe be a bit candid to some of them in the future as well with some of the excuses that they come out with.
Get ready for mine for the Manx. Get ready for mine. Ryan Champion, you told me you have an epic Any Other Business this week. I genuinely can't wait for this.
I don't know if I said epic. I said I think it's an interesting discussion point. Right, anyway, let's see. My Any Other Business this week started off with a look at the results from the Tour of Flanders rally. Tour of Flanders, a fantastic round of the Belgian Championship, a rally that I've done on a number of occasions. And it was won by Chris Van Wansel in a Mitsubishi Lancer World Rally car, one of the 05 Mitsubishis that was built in Rugby for the Mitsubishi World Rally team. But then as I went down the results, so Chris in the World Rally car beat some R5 cars. That was interesting. In fifth place was Eric Weavers again in a Subaru WRC, the last of the Pro Drive built Subaru WRC cars. Then in sixth overall was the first historic car. Now the first historic car being Paul Liotard, again a multiple winner of the Flanders Rally, but Paul Liotard was driving a Subaru Legacy RS. So the first historic car was a ProDrive spec Legacy that actually finished directly behind a ProDrive spec Impreza World Rally car. Now, this leads me really to my discussion point, and that is historic rallying. Where is it going to? So, as I've just said there, Paul Liotard won in Belgium in a ProDrive spec Legacy. If you want to build a ProDrive spec Legacy nowadays, you're talking a little bit of money there. You're actually seeing legacies changing hands now for anything up to £150,000 if they've got a bit of factory history. If you want to build one, it's going to be, and I know Mark II Escorts can cost this, but it's going to be well in excess of £120,000, probably getting up towards that £150,000 to build one. Now, obviously, you can't keep the historic date the same all the way through as years go by, or can you? But what we've seen is the FIA have obviously evolved with the years on a rolling basis. So now it's pre-1991, so it allows in things like the Legacy we've just mentioned. It brings in four-wheel drive Sierra Cosworths. It brings in Lancia Delta Integrales. Is that where we think historic rallying should be? Or should it be maybe the route that British historics have taken so far? And that, I think the cutoff date of that at the minute is pre-1986. So it's all two-wheel drive. It's non-turboed. You can use an Opel Manta 400 if you want. But such has been the development of the Escort, the Mark II Escort over the years, that's still really the front-running historic car with other things like the Fiat and the 911 in there to occasionally challenge. But where do we think historic rallying should go?
I've had my hand up for the last 30 seconds waiting for the teacher to say, go on, Tony.
Go on, Tony.
Thanks,
over
mate.
To
right.
you.
I think that's a really, really good Any Other Business, by the way. And the first thing I thought of all the way through that was, yeah, but all those events over there are all tarmac events.
They are, but in general, we're still talking about FIA rules for historic rallying, regardless of.
I just wonder though how many of those people who own those cars and the values you've been quoting for a Legacy and stuff like that would put them into a forest.
I think there's two things. I don't know the full FIA Historic Rally Championship, but is that all on tarmac? Firstly, I don't know the answer to that. No, it isn't, because the Lahti Historic Rally, for example, in Finland, is around. So that's definitely one I know of. I don't know of the others, but that's just one I've thought of off the top of my head. But there's definitely gravel rallies in the FIA Championship. That was a newly built car, I think, for FIA Jack. Historic rallying. It wasn't a historic car. Go on, Jack. What do you think? Yeah.
My thoughts on that would be, you know, it's the biggest problem we get with rallying at the minute, and the biggest kind of debate point is always all the cars will always look the same, and they're not very spectacular, and they're not very exciting to watch, which, to be honest, I think is a load of rubbish, but that seems to be the sort of general consensus of what people think about current rallying. I think, you know, looking at the current British Historic Rally Championship, I don't cover it, but from reading it through Emma and stuff like that, I think it looks like a really competitive and entertaining championship. But one thing I will say about it is that it's pretty much dominated by escorts every single round. I think Rally North Wales had three or four non-escorts in the top ten, and I think that was the best of the year in terms of non-escorts in the top ten. So what I would say is that, you know, as long as it's fair and the class systems are set up properly, then we should be allowing things like the Legacy in, because that separates it from current rallying, and it keeps people in the sport. Because, you know, if you don't want to watch current rallying because you don't think it's very entertaining, then if you've got a Legacy, a Delta Integrale, and something else, you've got that range of stuff you can go and watch, and you know, it might not be driven as quickly as what the WRC cars, and it may not be as competitive, but at least you've got that sort of scope of different machinery that you can go and watch, and it keeps people in sport because it offers something different to what the World Championship and what the top national championship
there is. There you go. I think Jack's just summed up everything. There you go.
Then I've got a second point to it.
This just keeps, it's like the gift that keeps giving.
Well, so within FIA Historic, you can rally an Audi Quattro. You can rally a Lancia Ro 37, which has been FIA European Historic Champion several times. Yet they were banned in period. But as a historic car, you can rally them in the same specification. And it's the same with, for example, Sierra Cosworths. If you run a three-door Sierra Cosworth, I think it's a 38mm restrictor you have to run, but that's like 380 horsepower. But the point I'm making, coming back to the Group B cars, is you can legally run them in historic rallying. Now, they were banned in period, but they're not banned in historic rallying. And people might say, oh, well, they're historic cars, they're going slowly. I disagree with that one. And not only that, in period, they were maintained by factory teams to factory standards. Now these cars are 30 plus years old, using old parts looked after on the whole by some professional teams, some amateur teams. Is it safe to run those cars?
Yeah, think about how many service crews there back in the day, and how many people were looking after the cars, and they were experts who developed the parts in to start with, hadn't they? So, you know, you were talking about test teams earlier, Tony, that, you know, they were building the cars and developing them and then servicing them on the event, so they had a lot more experience with the parts and stuff. Just to react to basically what you said there, right, I think it's a more general problem in rally, in that we've got too many regulations, and regulations that don't always fit different championships. So, you know, perfect example of that was the Australia in the year, where the BRC have got an inclusion in their regs where they can declare a wet rally and allow people to use wet tyres, but because an FIA Celtic Trophy was also on the event, you know, it really caused an issue for the scrutineers, the stewards and the organisers, as to whether they could declare a wet rally because this FIA Championship was competing there. So I think there does need to be a big look at how national regulations work in rally and how they apply to different championships, because, you know, an issue you've raised there quite rightly is that, you know, some Group B cars in certain countries can compete in different championships depending on what regs they're running to, and in some countries they can't. So there needs to be a good look at how regulations are written and which championships.
I don't think it's so much the regs, though, Jack, to be honest with you. The point I'm taking from what Rai said there is that, is it safe? Is it safe to have, you know, these cars that, you know, they were maintained by factory teams, they had professional rally drivers. Now we've got a situation where perhaps, you know, a good amateur team or even a professional team, not with professional rally drivers, be driving cars that were effectively banned in period.
And that's my point. I mean, don't get me wrong, I'm the first that wants to see a Lancia Ro 37 or a Renault 5 Turbo or, you know, or Group B cars in action on rallies. Fantastic. But it does bring us to a safety question. It has to.
Yeah.
I'd disagree with what you said there, Tony, just because the regs are what allow the cars to compete. You know, I accept there is a safety issue, but if the regs are right, then we don't get the safety issue because those cars are dealt with. You know, they use a smaller restrictor or something along those lines. So, you know, I think that does really, it's a really, really good point, actually, and it's something that does need to be looked at.
And it's a fine line as well. You know, we have a lot of demonstration events in the UK, but it's normally a fairly small contained area where it is well marshalled, where it's a fairly safe environment, and it's great to see the Group B cars running in that sort of environment. But when you're talking about, you know, the open environment of a rally, they were prone to setting on fire in 1985. You know, unfortunately, they haven't got that isn't going to have cured itself in the intervening 30 years.
I think, you know what, right, I think this is a debate that needs to be allowed to breathe. And what I mean is by that, I think we need to revisit it next week, perhaps for 10 minutes or so. But the people who are listening to the podcast now, let us know your thoughts on this, because I feel like we're kind of we're in a strange situation here, because Jack kind of had his thoughts and he disagreed with what I said, and I kind of see where Rye's going and I clarified that, but we still, I don't think there's a right or wrong answer to this one, and I think our listeners need to get involved for us to actually come back to it next week. I really do. Yeah, are we up with that, boys?
Absolutely. Let's throw it out there,
please. Yeah, please, everyone, get in touch. Let us know what you think by Twitter and Facebook and all that sort of stuff.
And even further, you know, as while we're on the point, where do we think British Historic Rallying should go? We're not in a position to make the comment, but we've seen the FIA open the regulations up to newer cars. Do we think that the British Historic Championship should do that, or should they stay with where they are now?
Get in contact, folks. You know how to find us. It's @Absolute_Rally on Twitter and facebook.com/AbsoluteRally, and you can drop us messages on there. And all being well, we will have the new website coming in the next month or so as well. So there'll be blogs and stuff, and you'll be able to email the show and things like that. So I'll tell you more about that next week. But we've massively ran over our target time that I give every podcast, but I think it's been worth it. This one kind of fired up towards the end. It got going slowly, but towards the end, it ignited, and it was with Ryan's Any Other Business, which he did tell us about, to be fair. But, folks, we are now going to cross over, and but no more smoke and mirrors. Obviously, we've recorded this section, and I've already spoke to Michael Patterson from Patterson Pace Notes, and Zav McCartan joined us on that one as well, following on from a piece he did with him at Lurgan Park a month or so back. So, boys, same time, same place next week.
Yeah, absolutely.
I'm quite excited. Absolutely. It's gonna be the day before I leave for the Manx, so we can talk about that as well. And hopefully we're gonna have some special guests on, possibly even a former winner of the Manx Rally. So more will be revealed leading up to the podcast anyway. But folks, sit back, relax, enjoy the rest of the podcast with myself, Zav, and Michael Patterson, and Ryan and Jack. See you next week.
This is the Absolute Rally Podcast. Team Coordinate, your perfect travel partner for all your European, Manx and Irish motorsport travel. Whether you're a competitor, marshal or a motorsport fan, we have the connections and discounts available for ferry travel to and from the UK. Team Coordinate, we can cater for individuals, teams or group bookings. Working with organisers of race, rally and classic touring events, we take away the hassle of travel with bikes, cars, trailers and trucks, accompanied or unaccompanied. Team Coordinate. Call Dane or Donna now on 44 1904 766787 or email us on info@teamcoordinate.com. This is Absolute Rally.
Welcome back to Absolute Rally. It's good to be back. It's good to be back with somebody actually whose voice I've heard probably for the last 18 years of my, and I use this word very, very loosely, of course, rally career. Pass and Pace Notes, which is a system which, as I say, I've grown up with my rally career and everything else. And what I want to try and do with the podcast over the next few months is kind of bring people in, maybe the unsung heroes and things that perhaps we take for granted. And there's also stuff that goes on in rallying that, you know, the casual fan probably really doesn't realise. So, you know, everybody's heard of Pace Notes, everybody's heard of different descriptions and things like that. And I just thought I'd get the man who kind of, as I say, he's been all the way through my career and many other people. So for the first time, and hopefully it won't be the last time, welcome to Absolute Rally, Michael Patterson.
Hello, Tony. How are you? How are you keeping?
Well, we're good. We're good. We spoke very briefly off air in inverted commas last night. I'm just getting ready for Rally Isle of Man, so I'm already used to listening to your voice. As I say, it's an invaluable service. Now, Zav, who is a friend of the show, who bullies his way on, has been openly encouraging us to speak to you since he spoke to you at Lurgan Park. And I know Zav spoke to you about a few different bits and parts. And, I'll tell you what, you know what? Zav's with us because he just bullies his way in. So I'm going to hand it over to Zav. I want Zav to kind of chat to you about what he was talking to you about at Lurgan, because, again, it sounded fascinating and I want our listeners to hear it as well.
Hello, Zav.
That's great. I've bullied my way onto the show and I'm taking over. But as Tony has said there, the unsung heroes in rally, and I suppose with the advent of in-car cameras and how everything has progressed, those of us within the sport would have an idea of pace notes when they're called, you know, from the World Rally Championship down to single venue events. But it's what amazed me was the deep work that goes into it. And obviously, Michael, when I caught up at Lurgan Park, and went with you for a run round the park, I was fascinated and amazed by just the amount of machinery and technical equipment that, you know, your car is equipped with that produces the type of notes that, you know, a lot of people would be familiar with, some people wouldn't. But I was really keen that Tony got you on just to sort of discuss the history of pace notes, how they came about, how you get, you know, how you put them together. I mean, your life is never, your rally 3 and 4 months, you know, before we are. And there's an awful lot of work goes into it.
Yeah, there is, Zav, and it's one of those things that we just quietly get on with it to a certain extent. But modern technology has dictated that we have moved with the times. We now adapt and have adopted some very, very technical aspects to making the notes. But it's a long, far cry from back in the early 1980s, when route notes, or safety notes as they're still known today, became more prolific on Irish rallies, but also rallies like the Scottish Rally and Rally GB, RAC as it was then, used to supply organiser supplied notes. You got one system, one type. If I remember rightly, doing the Scottish Rally once in the late 1980s, they were a 6 fastest type description. You came and you did the Circuit of Ireland. They provided you with a descriptive set of notes. But it really went back to the early 1980s when Terry Harriman and my father, Brian Patterson, decided that they would provide a commercially available service to people who didn't have the knowledge or expertise to do their own notes, basically. Terry's career was on the verge of taking off again with Ari Vatanen. So that didn't, Terry was had to go basically on and do the WRC in the Works Peugeots. That's a story in itself, obviously. And the thing really developed from there on. It's been a long road and it's a completely different ballgame today. You know, the competitors now are much more au fait, much more technical about their own notes. So we feel that we have moved along with that, and there's a lot of aspects of it have moved along as well.
Yeah, I mean, I was fascinated by the fact that I got a run with you around Lurgan Park, and you had the young lady whose name escaped me on the laptop, and she just hit the enter button. And I remember you giving me a time for that stage and telling me it was going to be, you know, 2:58, dependent on the weather. And I was amazed to discover, I think it was on the Saturday, that the following day you were within 3 seconds. And the technology you have, you can tell the undulations on a stage. You know, for example, you know, in Scotland there, as you say, some of the forests, you know, they climb 800-900 meters. And that you can advise organisers about nowadays with target times, where to actually place a bale and slow the whole thing down. I mean, things have moved on an awful lot. You know, you say in the 80s there it was Terry and your dad, but I mean, for roundy fans, I think they would first come across pace notes, if you remember Dennis Jenkinson and Stirling Moss on the Mille Miglia. And when Dennis went with Stirling and beforehand on like a toilet roll, wrote out bend after bend. And that was where some of it came from. And that would be the nearest that some of the roundy fans would have. But I was just amazed with the technology you know, when you look back through some of your in-car, how notes have progressed, you know, since the sort of mid-70s, late-70s. A lot of the European events were allowing pace notes back then, but it has moved on tremendously, Michael. It really has.
Yeah, yes, it has. It has moved on tremendously. We're very lucky. The technical side, we have worked very closely with a company in Sweden called Jemba, who are also the manufacturer of the Coralba rally computers. And the chap who runs that company and owns the company is a former fairly well-known co-driver called Arne Johansson. A few of the slightly older listeners may remember him coming to the British Rally Championship around about year 2000 with Matt Sanderson in the Works Proton at the time, run by Harry Hockley. So Arne has a very good grasp of co-driving, and he still co-drives today in Sweden, but he's a former military, Swedish military guy, computer engineer, and he has designed this, basically what we call the Jemba inertia pace note system over the last 15 years or so, along with several partners around the world. It's a standard issue in the United States, for instance. If you were doing the USA Championship, you get the Jemba, pure Jemba notes. We work slightly differently in that we have obviously got an extremely well-established system that we have used, people like Tony have used and got used to over the years. And it has developed into numerous different systems that suit various different people, whether it's a descriptive system or numbers or reverse numbers, six being fast or one being fast or whatever. But we run in parallel the Jemba system, almost like a silhouette over our own notes. And quite a lot of the competitors are probably listening going, oh, that's that guy from the DVD. And they'll sometimes hear me saying something like plus one or minus one when I'm reading the notes back when we're doing our own recce. And that's where the Jemba system has reported a corner, either one call faster or one call slower. And where we get the two to marry up pretty much most of the time, the Jemba system is amazingly accurate. It uses lots and lots of sensors, so there's no point in going into the absolute technicality of it, along with gyroscopes and also the data and distance from the Coralba trips, which generate, I think off the top of my head, 200 pulses per second. So there's 200 bits of information coming back every second. So that's a lot of information. And it then can measure the radius of every corner. It can measure elevation into dips and crests and jumps very, very accurately. So we're able to overlay that information over our own human interpretation of that. Our experience of driving over the stages is really invaluable as well. So we've decided to keep our own system with basically the Jemba system backing us up. And actually, you know, you're saying about organisers using the information. It's been very helpful this year in predicting some of the average stage times on some of the rallies. And in fact, the Scottish rally this year was looking a little bit negligible in a couple of stages after some of the Pirelli rally having a problem with the bogey times. So we were able to advise the organisers about putting in a chicane here or slowing down some speed reduction measures or whatever. But of course, all this means it's a very labour intensive thing. And, you know, each rally probably, whilst we're on the road for maybe a day doing the rally, there's probably two or three days after that where we're in the office where everything gets double checked. It's checked off the video. It's humanely checked. The original notes are checked against the last draft. And it's a fairly intensive sort of thing that we never stop working at it, Savitz. But all this information is really, really helpful as well. And of course, it reassures the competitor that what they're actually getting is very accurate, good information that's consistent and, more importantly, safe.
Now, we're, as Tony says, are getting geared up Rally Isle of Man next week and Wales Rally GB. You're at events, what, 2, 3, 4 months before competitors are?
Not quite as far as that. Generally about 3 weeks before. We try and leave it as late as possible so that we get a good idea of the road conditions relative to the event. So the Isle of Man we actually did 2 weeks ago, because the first recce, I think, is this weekend. So we work on a basis that we go and do it. We get the notes turned around. We get the DVD turned around, and now the digital online version of the DVD and the digital version of the notes. And then the posted version, we try and get out about a week ahead of, in this case, the first recce. So most of the competitors have now got their notes and their DVD for the Isle of Man. They know what a massive event is in store for them. And I don't say that lightly. The Isle of Man is one of those events that is, we're so lucky to have it. The organisers do an amazing job. And anybody who's going to do that rally, to drive around the Isle of Man for 3 days on those closed roads, they're in for some treat, including you, Tony.
Yeah, I'll be honest with you. I've got a mixed emotions, really. I'm mega, mega excited, and also, what's the best way of putting this? In most things that I do, whether it be stand up, whether it be presenting, or driving rally cars, when I'm lucky enough to do that, you never find a constipated rally driver. You never find a constipated comedian. I think that's probably the easiest way of putting it, to be perfectly honest with you. The nerves are already starting to kick in, and I'm looking forward to the recce. I'm kind of, I don't know how you guys do it. And genuinely, it was another reason why I wanted to talk to you. You know, when I've gone away and done international rallies where we've got to go away, and we've done, you know, the international rally GB and things like that, the intensity of being in a car with somebody for a day or two and trying not to actually end up in a fist fight at the side of the road is phenomenal. How do you keep it so you don't annoy each other so much when you're doing these notes in the car?
I don't really have an answer to that. I laugh to myself that competitors, obviously, we have a great relationship with most competitors, and some of them text me and they say, oh, what was that little, what were those words about? And Steve Perez sent me a text a couple of years ago where he was going to do the outtakes from the DVD. Some of them are quite witty, but you know, we treat it very professionally, Tony. It's easy to laugh and joke about it. I mean, I was basically a professional co-driver in the late 80s and the early 90s. You learn to be, you treat it as professionally as you can. When you get up in the morning, you get your breakfast and you hit the road. And yeah, you just yeah. get your head down and you do your job. If either, and generally it's my dad and myself, so we need to get on the best, but it's not always my dad. There's a few other people who help us out. And if we ever have a question mark over something, or we're not sure, we stop, we talk about it. If we think that something's maybe a bit dangerous, or in the notes, that we will actually stop and have a good discussion about it. What we also do then is, when we get back to the office, we'll have a talk about it as well. But on a personal level, you need to get on with people. It's just the same as when you go rallying. A driver and co-driver is such a special relationship that I think only rally people really get it. I really like what Saab said, going back to Jenks and Stirling Moss and the Mille Miglia in the mid-1950s. You know, they alluded to as much that they had a special relationship, that Moss had this enormous respect for Dennis Jenkinson, who was, I think, probably one of the best motorcycle racers of his time, and certainly a sidecar champion. And Moss respected that. And I think you have this huge respect in rally cars between driver and co-driver. A good driver respects a really good co-driver, and a really good co-driver has huge respect for their drivers. And that's a mutual thing that, you know, you may not necessarily go to the pub together for a drink, but you probably spend quite a lot of time together on the phone, for instance. And it's just a professionalism that is almost a given in rallying, that you take for granted almost.
Now, you've just mentioned how technology is moved on, and you obviously the system has moved on, and what you do has moved on, and everything else. Would you say, and again, you know, obviously when we first started using the notes many, many years ago, you correctly kind of pointed out, well, you know, the route notes, safety notes and things like that. But do you agree, over a period of time now, you've got a situation, obviously with Gemba and stuff like that, that the notes have got faster and they're almost now becoming more pace note than route note?
No, I wouldn't, Tony. I would say we always, we are guided very much by people like the MSA, Motorsport Ireland. We have a very close working relationship with these people. What the GEMBA system has done, it has fine-tuned it, but we are very much on the side of safety. We won't tell you to cut corners, for instance. We won't tell you how to drive the car. That's your responsibility as a driver. All we can do is describe the road ahead to the best of our ability. The technology has enabled us to do it much more accurately, much more precisely. But people must always remember that there's safety notes in the UK, and that if you want to make a change, that's your responsibility. We're not here to tell you how fast to go. All we can do is advise you and describe the road ahead.
Now,
I must admit, the safety thing, yes, I'd agree with Michael there, because one of the things that got me thinking a bit more about the job that Michael and people like Michael do. Michael, if I remember correctly, about 18 months ago, now you have your website where you do the little video clips and loads of information of Patterson Spacements, but one of the things you put out in social media, if I remember, you took the time to take, you know, everybody can buy an in-car camera now, you know, for insurance purposes, road crashes, all that kind of thing. But you went to the effort of taking one of those cameras and going onto a stage, and taking your cameras and going onto a stage and showing the difference, you know, when people are trying to use their own in-car camera, the difference that camera view gives of a bend. And I was fascinated by that, because it showed that the degree of professionalism and pace note making is unbelievably high. And that's why the cameras that you use give that view of a bend, as opposed to the ones that everybody has, the dash cameras nowadays. It's a, you know, the same bend, but two totally different views.
Yes, it's a very technical thing, Sav, and it's something we've always been very conscious of. We've always used broadcast cameras. The irony of this is that we first started putting video cameras in the car in the 1990s for our own purposes. And I think it was Mark Higgins found out on what used to be the Vauxhall Rally of Wales that we had a videotape of our Ricky. And he sort of said, would there be any chance of getting a copy of that? But even then, we used basically a broadcast standard camera, because we found that bullet cams, they give a different perspective. They're a wider angle than a normal camera. And without getting into the absolute technicality of it, it's very, one of the things is the wider angle. If you think something is 2 foot wide, but you want to squeeze it into a 12-inch screen, it's going to be squashed, and therefore it straightens the corners out. It makes it look fast, but it doesn't give you a true representation of what the corners are. So we actually, over the years, have had very, very sophisticated, and still do have very sophisticated systems with multi-cameras. But the MSA decided around about 2010, 2011, that they only wanted one forward-facing camera. A lot of people have asked about where did the side cameras go, where we could see into the ditches and everything else. It was basically, the MSA felt that it was getting just a little bit too good, and there was a little bit too much information coming from it. So we stick with a broadcast camera that gives as close to a realistic view as we possibly can. We have the mileage so that people, if they want to look at the length of a corner, very important on gravel rallies in particular, where you can maybe start getting out of a corner earlier than what you may think you can, because we know the distance. And we have the steering wheel, which shows the angle of the turn, which is very important for some of the drivers. So we're working with, we now find that somebody like Chris Meek, going back a couple of years ago, Chris sat down one day, phoned me up and said, look, your camera does this. Why does my camera look faster? And explained to him. And he got it straight away. So he uses a camera now that he's able to do a regular screen, as opposed to 1080p widescreen, 180 degrees or 134 degrees, stuff like this. So it's all down to the angle of the camera, the angle of the camera lens, and the amount of width it takes in, and the lack of distortion, basically.
There you go.
I remember seeing it and just thinking, blimey, the difference was just, it was, but from the safety point of view, very, very good to put out, because then people, I think, stopped doing it, you know. Very good.
Well, I remember about that time, a fairly good driver, having done a rally the previous year, getting his onboard camera, using it with that year's notes and thinking, oh, this is a slow corner, and he upgraded the corner and had a problem on the rally, went off the road. And about a week later, he was on the phone to me and he said, I had no idea. I upgraded the corner. I went against what you said on the notes. I made it faster. According to my onboard camera from last year, he said, now I understand why. I totally get it. He said, it doesn't give you a true representation of the road ahead.
Yeah, fascinating.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned about Steve Perez's outtakes, and the reason why, because there's always one that always sticks with me from watching one of your DVDs. And there's a few, every now and again I'll get a smile from something and there'll be a titter, but there was one that actually made me stop, rewind and watch it again repeatedly and show it to other people. And it was Rally Sunseeker. It was 2012 and there was a lady, I think, with a double buggy. I think she had about 14 dogs.
I remember this.
I just remember hearing you say, and I'll paraphrase ever so slightly, for the love of God, haven't you got enough on your plate, woman?
Yes, that was quite funny. And I'll tell you what, she did have enough on her plate.
So, Michael, listen, before we, as ever with Absolute Rally, we always go off on tangents and stuff like that. But just to come, where do you see the next evolution come from for you guys? Can it get any sharper? Can it get any better? Because it just seems to be at the pinnacle of what it can be with the parameters that you have to work to now.
Well, I appreciate that, and that's great to hear that, Tony. To be honest, we're always working to make it better. One of the things that is the video is a very important aspect. So we've taken that a step forward in the last couple of years by offering it now a digital version. And that takes a lot of work to get that right, where you get it's not too big a file. All the geeks out there will appreciate what I'm saying. You don't make a big, massive file, because They're pretty long, some of these DVDs. I mean, you're doing the Isle of Man next week. The DVD's 3 hours and 15 minutes long. And we get that onto one DVD without too much trouble. But the digital version of it is obviously something that people can put on their iPad and stuff like that. With the actual notes, we never stop trying to improve it. We never stop taking on board what competitors say. We're also always listening to what the MSA say. And I think with regards to UK rallying, we are dictated by what the MSA want to do moving forward, particularly with the forests. We know there are problems with the arrangements with NRW, and part of it is all in negotiation, but things like berms on the insides of corners to keep people from cutting and doing less damage and stuff like that, that will always dictate pretty much where the notes go. But we're always fine-tuning. The next step, I think, for ourselves and the notes is we've always taken on board the competence of the drivers and co-drivers. You get people who are obviously very experienced and people who are not so experienced. And we have to strike a happy balance with that, that people who have been around a long time maybe want a bit more information, and people who are not so experienced want to take out a little bit of information. So we're always fine-tuning how much information we do put in. And I think maybe the next step is to define the corners slightly more precisely. When that happens, probably next year or the year after, we're seriously considering putting a minus in the notes, just to give us what will effectively be another 7 or 8 possibilities on the grid. The plus at the moment is we're getting great feedback from people. They've found that we have a call, say a 5 right or a 5 right plus, where they know they can go slightly faster. Where we use the word tight sometimes, but we feel that maybe bringing in a minus on a corner might broaden the scope for a bit more precision. But it is something we're talking to drivers about, and people like yourself, you know, appreciate your feedback on these things.
Well, I was gonna say, I actually use minuses, to be honest. I actually do put minuses on your notes, and on the acute corners, I also have a go deep.
Okay.
Which basically tells me don't try and get it on the bar so tight. Actually, go deep, and then come round, and you'll get the car round rather than trying to take the acute corner.
Yes, yes.
No,
go ahead.
No, and that's kind of, and again, like you've just been saying, over a period of time, these are things that I've developed kind of my own system on the way you've, I suppose, overlaid the Gemba system on yours. I've overlaid my system, I suppose, onto yours. And I have things like, you know, anything over 200 is a go, which means if I get a 200 go, I know I can push. Anything under 200, it's still quick, but I'm still know there's a tighter corner coming up at the end of it and things like that. So that's kind of how I've developed it over the last 10 years, to be honest with you, more so than before. Before I was probably quite nervous to make too many changes. And then it got to the stage where it wasn't making changes. It was just making it more, turning it into what I wanted to hear in my head when I was on the rally.
Yeah, and I think that's the secret of most people who are rallying. I mean, I know Declan Boyle, for instance, who's top driver in Ireland, hardly changes a note. He hardly does anything. Frank Kelly is the same. He wouldn't make any changes at all, other than one or two annotations about a braking point or anything else. He never changes the angles of the corners, and he'll put the occasional go in. And that goes back to, we're not there to tell you how to drive. We're only there to describe the road ahead. And I also feel that as an exercise, sitting down with the notes and the DVD before a rally, it sharpens your own expectations up. You can actually, you're studying much harder when you are trying to improve the notes for yourself.
Absolutely. I think we could do a whole podcast on notes, and I'm just conscious of time because we've already pinched half an hour of your time. Now, before we let you go, we've kind of gone into this habit of this any other business malarkey now, or anybody who comes on, it's kind of got the floor is theirs to get anything off there. Is there anything you'd like to get off your chest about rallying, good, bad, or indifferent at the moment?
I don't think you've got a podcast long enough, Tony. I actually don't have much to say at the moment. I think that we're in difficult times. I think the MSA is dealing with their own problems. I think Motorsport Ireland have got their problems. Based in Northern Ireland, the Northern Ireland Championship is close to where I started my own rallying. I did my very first rally on the Lakeland Stages, which happened last weekend, and Enniskillen Motor Club ran another super event. But I feel that probably I'd like to see the Northern Ireland Championship raise its profile a little bit again. It seems to have gone a little bit flat this year. The Southern Forestry, or the Irish Forestry Championship, is on the up, which is fantastic. But the Northern Ireland Championship is something I'd like to see improving a little bit. I don't know what the answer is. There are some clever people in the Association of Northern Ireland Car Clubs working very hard for 2017. I think there'll be a few changes. The Circuit of Ireland not happening next year is part of that. So where the rally had to accommodate a round of its ASN's national championship, that's not going to happen. But other than that, I think on the one hand, rallying's very, very healthy at the moment, despite a lot of problems faced at the highest levels.
Absolutely. Great one. Zav, you normally have a lot to say. I'm not entirely sure it's always valid, but hey, we've given you the platform. You're a guest host now, I can say that. Go on. What's your any other business this week, my friend?
Well, just before I go to any other business, one of the things I would say, if you're like me, a rally anorak, Michael himself occasionally tweets out on social media little snippets. Now, for listeners who are really interested in the technical side of rallying, such as how notes are made, if you follow up Pace Notes on Twitter, you'll see Michael put out little bits and pieces. And for those that have developed more interest, can follow there or check Patterson's Pace Notes website. My any other business is It's an odd one for me. I want to doff my cap to two people. If he'd still been alive, it would have been Greg Strange's birthday on the Monday after the Ulster rally, at which I was lucky enough to be open to radio with Tony Kelly and Chris Ross. But sadly, last Friday, there was a gentleman called Pete Silverberg passed away. Now, I'd known Pete for quite a few years, and he had worked with Greg, who founded Rally Radio, but Pete was the instrumental driving behind WRC results, ERC results, and was one of those unsung heroes in rallying literally around the world. And I first met Pete, having known him for a while, on the Wednesday of Greg's funeral. The two of us on the Thursday made our way to Mull and honoured an undertaking to Ian Campbell to Scunner that Mull Radio would take place, which it did. And Peter, I think the first time ever he did radio, he hosted the radio from the Harbour Master's office in Tobermory. And we made good our commitment to Mull Rally back then, and just the fact that there's only 9 days between a birthday and a passing away, I just want to doff my hat to Greg Strange and Pete Silverberg.
Very nicely put, Sav. Very nicely put. And yeah, couldn't have put it better myself. I'll do my only other business with you guys now, and my only other business is advice more than anything. So, one piece of advice from Michael, Rally Isle of Man next week, please.
Enjoy it. It's good advice. It's one of the best rallies you will ever do. That and Rally GB, they're special, special events. To go, the volunteers, the Motor Club and the Isle of Man put on one of the most amazing events. It's relentless, Tony. It's fantastic. Fair play to the organisers. And I think the entry reflects it. It's such a special rally to do. Go and enjoy it. Don't get concerned. Go and have a ball.
Do you know what? They are that's the best piece of advice I've had so far. Thank you, Michael. That's what we'll go and do. Listen, at this point, this is where...
Do I get to advise you?
No, you don't get to advise me at all. I took advice from you once and look where it got me.
Yeah, I know.
Do you want to give me a piece of advice, Sav? Come on, you can if you want.
No, go and enjoy it. Michael's right. I mean, if you look at the Manx National, the Manx International, the Isle of Man, it's a special place, spiritual place. Not just the rallying, but the TT. There's something special about it. You know, the stages up through the mines, the fog, the rain on one side of the island can be bright sunshine in Douglas. You know, it's why the likes of, you know, Kenny McKinstry, Paul Bird, everybody has gone over done the national and the international. You know, Colin McRae loved the place. Richard Burns loved it. It is, as Michael says, it is a really special, special place. And, you know, they worked their socks off, all the organisers, to provide a great rally for not just the crews, spectators, all the officials. Yeah, a super event.
Great words, great words. I'll take that one on board as well. Folks, thank you so much for the download, by the way. If you've hit the download button on iTunes, really, really do appreciate it. You can find us on Podbean as well. And, yeah, as I say, if you're not following us on Facebook, look us up on facebook.com/absoluterally. We are on Twitter at @absolute_rally, but you probably know that by now. I'd like to think you do anyway. We will have one more program before Rally Isle of Man. We're hoping to have a former winner of Rally Isle of Man with us next week. Michael, thank you so much for joining us on Absolute Rally.
My pleasure, and it's great to be on here. And all the best next week. I hope it really, really goes well for you, Tony.
Fantastic. Thanks, Michael. Zav, it's a pleasure as ever. I say that very tongue-in-cheek, but thanks for joining us and being one of our substitute presenters again.
No, pleasure. And Michael, thanks for coming on. I've been at you for long enough, but really good to get you on. Really good.
Anytime you want me to come on, guys, just give me a shout and I'll make myself available.
Fantastic. Thanks, Michael, for joining us. And thank you for the download, folks. As I say, we'll have another podcast next week before Rally Isle of Man, and then we'll have another couple before the end of the season. But yeah, we're going to be doing some different stuff over the next few weeks. So please spread the word. Tell your friends. Absolute Rally's here every Wednesday in your little download hole, wherever that may be. Again, appreciate the download, folks. Speak to you next week.